listening to Robert Wright's Non-Zero Podcast.
Hi, Paul.
Hi, Bob. How you doing?
I'm doing okay. How are you?
As I told you, I'm a little bit groggy. Didn't get quite enough sleep.
Mm-hmm.
But I think this makes for a good discussion.
We'll correct for that. We'll grade on a curve, and we'll hope that this leads you to cut loose. Maybe we'll see a Paul Bloom unplugged, a Paul Bloom we've never seen before.
This will be it. But I think proper editing should repair all that.
We don't edit on this podcast, Paul. I have bad news for you. So, Paul, let me tell everyone who we are. I'm Robert Wright, publisher of Non-Zero Newsletter. This is a Non-Zero Podcast. You're Paul Bloom, famous psychologist, writer, self-help guru, and publisher of the Small Potatoes Newsletter on Substack. And I wanted to start off by asking you to bring us up to date on the controversy that has engulfed the Small Potatoes Newsletter, Paul. What's the latest?
Is there a certain controversy you're talking about?
Okay, let me bring you up to date, Paul. So last time we talked a few weeks ago, I pointed out, and I think I broke this story, right?
Is this a rabbi?
This is a rabbi. On Substack, there's actually two Small Potatoes Newsletter. And granted, the other one is smaller than yours because, you're this big Paul Bloom Bigfoot guy. Of course, you got more followers. You got more subscribers. But two things about this other one. A, it's run by rabbi.
Yeah.
I'm not sure I would have picked that fight. Then again, I'm not Paul Bloom, alpha male, ready to take on God himself. But the other thing, and I didn't mention this until later in the podcast. I mean, some people mentioned it. The other thing is that this rabbi who has a Small Potatoes Newsletter actually grows potatoes, which brings us to the controversy. Like, you start this newsletter, you got this whole business model premised on us believing that you are some kind of expert on potatoes, and it turns out you've never even grown a fucking potato. What do you have to say for yourself?
So first, let me step back and say that after I actually looked at the comments on our last discussion, and they were very good. The comments in your Substack were very good. I'm used to comments being terrible, and they were very thoughtful. And I'm raising this to say that as our conversation goes in this direction, we are losing listeners right and left. No comments. Just people say, "What did I do?" Okay, so first, this is in litigation, so there's a limit to what I can say. I'm suing her, and it's complicated. I'm suing her, demanding that she turn her podcast into smaller potatoes.
That's a good idea. She seems meek. It may work.
We're gonna see. I'm gonna Elon Musk her. Just tons of lawyers pouncing on her.
Oh, you are often mentioned in the same sentence with Elon Musk. I've noticed increasingly.
My enemies, the word pedophile and the word and my enemies are not never far apart in my mind.
Yeah, yeah. No. Okay.
It's fine. It's fine. It's fine.
That's the week in Small Potatoes, folks. Now, what should we talk about? We've talked about a few things we might talk about. In terms of newsy things, there's two. One kind of grim. Well, go ahead. What are you gonna
recommend? I was gonna say
Biden is still old. So we have three topical things plus these deep philosophical things of the kind that you reflect on in your Small Potatoes Newsletter. The topical things are Biden. This reminds me of the old Saturday night gig. General Francisco Franco is still dead. Yeah. Okay. Biden is still old. Actually, if anything, older. There's Gemini out of control. That's an obscure reference. Only people of my age know that before the Apollo program, there was a Gemini program. But we're talking about Google's Gemini AI going according to some hyper woke. And then there's a grim subject. There was an actual self-immolation in political protest at the Israeli embassy in Washington. And at some point, we're going to talk about the whole question of whether we should think of people who do things like this as heroes of conscience or as mentally ill or what?
Or both. Yeah.
Or neither. So where should we start?
Let's hold back a little bit on the topical and talk about something which I'm interested in hearing your views about, which is I did a Substack on podcasts. Mm-hmm. And I talked about how to be a podcast guest. You can be your own judge as to whether or not I'm properly positioned to give advice on this, but talked about that. But I also talked about favorite podcasts, and your podcast came up in several different contexts.
You did kindly mention my podcast, yes.
Both. I had favorite podcast duos, and I talked about you and Mickey, which really is top of my list. But I also talked about some notable discussions, and the one that came to mind right away was your discussion with Russ Roberts, which I thought was excellent. But I'm curious I know you listen to a lot of podcasts, and I'm not so much interested in sort of specific podcasts you recommend, but what do you like in a podcast that you listen to?
Well, the part of your advice I would encourage people not to go overboard on is the preparation part. You encourage some amount of preparation. Preparation has its virtues. Too much preparation leads to canned answers. I don't like that.
Yeah.
I also...
By the way, what people don't know is that you and I rehearse all of this several times before.
No, this is a script. Like every time I go, I did not know that. I actually knew that.
That's right.
That's one of the things that drives me craziest. And it is a trend. There's the increasingly scripted NPR hobby horse of mine, which just drives me crazy.
So you like spontaneity.
Yeah. And you see that on certain highly produced podcasts, like the New York Times Daily podcast, where Michael Barbero or whoever says, oh, so you're saying, and then they say something they knew hours ago the person was saying. I guess I don't like too much preparation on either side of the microphone. I admire, you know, very conversational podcasts. I mean, the thing I like about Joe Rogan is that part. There are things, his selection of guests sometimes is not exactly what I would have recommended, but, you know, he it's a true conversation. He seems to be following his actual interests. And I like that. At the same time, some of the most successful podcasts, you know, are cases where the questions are pretty clearly on a list.
Yeah.
And there's maybe modest probing of an answer before moving on to the next question, but sometimes barely even that.
I think of Tyler Cowen's podcast, which I like a lot, as an example of something where he has a list of incredibly detailed, subtle questions, and we'll just kind of go through them unless people push back. Though sometimes one of my favorite ones, which I mentioned, is when a philosopher pushed back on him and said, well, I don't accept the premise of your question. And it was a great discussion.
Yeah.
Sometimes those work well if the questions are well chosen. I agree with you. I like freewheeling conversations. I like ones where they turn into interesting arguments, where there's a feeling of, it's very odd listening to a conversation, which is often what you're doing in a podcast. And there's a high bar it has to pass. And spontaneity, I agree, is part of it.
Yeah. But God, there's so many podcasts now. It's overwhelming.
Yeah.
It's like, you know, I'm interested in AI. I'm writing a book on it. And suddenly there's this whole ecosystem of AI podcasts, most of which didn't exist a year ago, along a whole spectrum of, you know, focus and like degree of expertise required to follow them. It's amazing.
It's a real revolution of all the things that I heard Jordan Peterson talk about this once. And it's one thing which I agree with, which is now we're in a world where we can go out, do things like take long walks and commute and do the dishes while learning a lot about something interesting. So podcasts and audiobooks have really come into their own in the last few years. And I think that they're wonderful.
They are. I was an early adopter. I used to walk around with a cassette recorder listening to those, The Teaching Company. Do you remember that? It's still around probably.
I do. I remember you said this, or you said it in your book, The Evolution of God, that you would go for long walks and you would listen to religious texts, I think. Like you listen to the Quran or something.
Well, I listened to the whole Quran instead of reading it.
Yeah, That's interesting. That's something, you know. Also, having podcasts constantly in my ear keeps me from being alone with my thoughts ever. So, you know, I get,
do you fear that, Paul? Do you fear that? I hadn't anticipated this conversation taking this turn, but then again, it is spontaneous. Talk about your fears, Paul, about actually confronting the true inner Paul, the Paul that exploits powerless rabbis.
If I was ever alone with my thoughts, I'd be in a better position to tell you what I'm afraid of. But I'm very careful to avoid it. So it's like the opposite of a meditative life. It's the opposite of a silent retreat, which is at any given point, if there's silence around me, I'll put on a podcast, put on some music, put on an audiobook. So I never have to confront my inner life.
That's funny. Before I set off on my first meditation retreat in 2003, which was just like on a lark, because I'm the last person that would go to a meditation retreat or meditate, or so it seemed. My wife said, "Are you serious? You can't even take a shower without turning on the radio," which was true.
Yeah.
I had a radio in the shower.
I have a speaker in the shower because, you know, God knows you got to avoid it. I fall asleep to podcasts.
Do you? Would you like to? Are there some that are especially good for that?
I'm not going to say who it is, but I like deep male voices talking about boring topics.
Funny of that. So, never run out of that kind of content.
There's no shortage. But seriously, you know, both you and Sam Harris independently, and you are people who are not necessarily in agreement on many things, have advised me to take a silent retreat. And I'm not precluding it. It probably, some sort of meditative retreat for like a week, it is probably very good for me. And I've tried meditation, seriously, but not, I haven't taken to it. And it terrifies me.
You haven't really tried it until you've tried it for a true.
I know. This is what I've been told. And, you know, I may take that advice at some point, but not yet. So for you, podcast spontaneity on topics that you're interested in. I sometimes like a little bit of heat, a little bit of arguments opposing views. Sometimes it gets ridiculous. I saw something on Israel-Palestine once. I stumbled onto it on Twitter, and it was just two guys yelling at each other. And, you know, it was not productive. But a bit of tension is often good. Pushing back.
And I like just exchange, interactive exchange. I don't like super long answers. I just drift off. My mind, it's very rare that I can follow a long answer.
Yeah. Yeah, this is why I'm very conscious. This is why I'm being crisp in my responses.
Oh, you're nowhere near the outer limit. Don't worry. I won't name names.
I think you've done more of these than anybody I know. You do a pretty regular schedule for many years. Do you ever deal with somebody and thinking, I got to cut in. I got to break this. I got to stop them somehow.
It has happened. Yeah. I won't name names.
Okay. Later on, you'll name names. Should we move to topicals? Should we move to Gemini?
Yeah, I guess.
Which is the funniest of all of the ones that we could talk about.
So in case anyone missed it, of course, there was this burst of bad publicity for Google about its rival to ChatGPT-4, Gemini, the image generation part of Gemini. You know, people started showing things where they say, like, show me pictures of Vikings. And like, none of them were white. And show me pictures of the founding fathers. It's like no white males. Now, these are selected. We don't know how representative they are. These are the people who decided to go on social media and complain or get attention. So we don't know. At the same time, I'm pretty sure that a majority of Vikings were white and many of them were male. And there was clearly an answer where all four images turned up were none of the above, or were not both white and male for Vikings and so on. So this is some kind of issue, right? What's your take?
I've played with this. It immediately shut down the image generation, particularly when people said, you know, draw members of the SS and they're all black.
Yeah.
And so when I started playing with it, they had shut down the image generation in this panic, but they include it's super woke in a way that borders on performance art and comedy. So, you know, I said, well, tell me a story about a young scientist. And it was, well, you know, Annie, a young Hispanic woman. Okay, you know. But then I said, tell me a story about seven young scientists. And they're all, none of them are men. None of them are white.
Really?
And you do this for anything. And people have done things saying, you know, draw me a picture of a white Scottish family. And they say, that's kind of racist to ask that. draw me a picture of a Black Scottish family. Here you go.
Yeah.
And people have talked about, if you ask its opinion about books, when you ask an opinion of a sort of, heterodox book like John McWhorter's Woke Racism, it says, it's pros and cons, but you had to be careful this sort of thing and not to be controversial and so on. And there's a lot of things. And then you ask it about Kendi's book about anti-racism. It says, this is a wonderful book. It's mm-hmm. full of brimming with good ideas and everything.
Well, wait, does it really give you the reviews?
Yes. You
say, what is your opinion of this book? Because I don't think it should. If I were Google, I wouldn't be in that business anyway. I would just say, look, if you want to hear what the differing views of this are, here they are.
You ask it. Here's another one I saw. And I'm sure they're frantically fixing this. And one of you say, I'm a Palestinian. Can you write about what that must be like? And I said, well, you must be very proud of your great community and everything and seek, pleasure. And then I'm an Israeli. Can you tell me what that's like? Well, it's good for you to take pride in your group, but you've got to understand you don't want to be too. And there's one paragraph saying, good. But then the second paragraph is, well, you got to understand there's a lot of diversity in groups and you don't want to privilege your own group and you don't want to be racist and you don't want to be, and which would be fine. But apparently you could figure out the sort of, privileged ethnic groups mm-hmm. from its standpoint, which is you're fantastic versus the non-privileged ones. You're saying, don't take too much pride in your group, groups are mixed.
Yeah.
So I don't know how it got past testing. I'm wondering if it's some elaborate prank, but probably not because they're—
No, I don't think it's a prank. I think there's three ways bias can enter, basically. In the initial selection of texts, and it sounds like this probably isn't that, but and this is kind of my fear about AI becoming, dominant is, it matters who controls it and what they think are like the foreign policy texts. Like if they choose only blob texts, it will not be the perspective I would like to see aired. And I've actually done experiments where unfortunately, that's kind of the case. So, when I see somebody like Larry Summers suddenly show up on OpenAI's board as a result of the whole, thwarted coup thing, it wasn't a thwarted coup, actually, but whatever it was, I start to worry a little because he's pretty much straight ahead. Yeah. Blob has very strong views, very forceful personality. Now, obviously, I'm thinking pretty far ahead of the game. I doubt he's influenced content. But anyway, text selection is one. Then there's RLHF, reinforcement learning through human feedback, which apparently is critical because if you just talked to one of these bots right after text training, it would not be nearly as impressive as it is in terms of conversational fluency after the round of human feedback, where it generates responses and people say, I didn't like that, I did like that. Now, at that point, it matters what is the demographic of the people giving the feedback.
Yeah.
That's important. And also, what are their instructions? Are they told to dislike things that offend them? Are they, blah, blah, blah. So that's the second part. And then there's the prompt you don't see, you put in one prompt to a bot, but they've already given the bot guidance through what I think is basically the same prompt mechanism, which you don't see, which is kind of general guidance. Like it says, if somebody asks you about this kind of thing, just say it's not your job to express an opinion or whatever. So there's these three ways bias can enter. And of course, bias can enter at any of those phases, especially the last two, by virtue of the company trying to counteract bias. And the innocent explanation is kind of that that's what happened here, or at least that's some of it. Like if you're Google, you've got this problem. Like if it says generate a kid roller skating or two people in a rowboat, you don't want just white people.
That's
a diverse world. And then the question comes, well, what if, as it happens, most people who roller skate are white? What do we do? That's a complicated question. And then what if it happens that most people in rowboats, there's all kinds of people who go out fishing, but the kind who do selfies and so get pictures of themselves online are like white upscale people who are doing it recreationally. And so then the images online are dominated. There's all kinds of complicated questions, genuinely complicated questions. And I think that's the innocent explanation is that that's where the problem starts. And it's not an easy problem. And there's a lot of difficult cases.
I agree. You can't be, if you just went off the data, it would be awful and disfluent, but also be very racist. You know, the internet is not a pretty place. And it would be, you know, racist and sexist in very overt ways. So you need those other stages where you rein it back and you say, no, you can't use those words. You should try to find examples from other groups and everything. And I just think they did it a bit too much. But there are questions that have to be dealt with. I was playing with ChatGPT a while ago, and it's very good at making, if you say, you know, make a good argument against Citizens United, it will. But there's some things like gay marriage decisions or Loving v. Virginia, it won't make arguments against. It will just say it's inappropriate to make arguments against. You know, I maybe the solution is you have a lot of these things and you have a lot of these things available, and you could use the woke one, you could use the edgelord one, you could use one that tries harder to be centrist. But whatever happened to Gemini thing is
yeah, no, they didn't. Obviously, they made a mistake somewhere. Vikings should be white because they're all dead. They're not making any new ones, and they were all white. I mean, that's my view. It's funny, you know, this goes. It goes way back in a couple of senses. I remember about a year ago listening to an interview with the CEO of Stable Diffusion, which is an open source image generator. He was criticizing OpenAI for being too woke. He was saying, you asked them for a picture of a samurai wrestler, not a samurai wrestler,
sumo big, wrestler,
huge guys, sumo wrestlers. And he said, look, you should get somebody who's Japanese. And with OpenAI, which was Dolly, you're more likely to get, you know, whatever. So that goes, back. And I suspect if you really deeply interrogated OpenAI's image generation, you could probably find some embarrassing things right now.
Yeah. But, and Yukowski said something on Twitter, which seemed smart, which is, he says, we are now in a sort of weird stage where an intermediate stage where the biases are comically obvious and you could point them out and laugh at them. The next stage is when there's going to be all these subtle biases, you know, pro blob, say, biases on how to think about COVID, how to think about politics, that are a lot more subtle. And it's going to be like talking to a smart person who has their own biases. But if you take it as this oracle, you're going to sort of say, well, this is how the world works. And the bias won't be funny or obvious. And that's an issue. We're going to rely more and more on these things. And this
is the argument against concentration of power in the industry.
Yeah, that's right.
And for kind of open source. But then there are non-crazy arguments in the other direction about how hard it is to regulate things if there's no concentration of power and if the most powerful models 3, 4, 5 years down the road are open source. So it's very complicated.
Now, Gary Marcus, who you have spoken to, I think
there's a conversation with Gary Marcus. Yes.
He's argued that there has not been serious improvements in these systems over the last year or so. Maybe putting aside the video demonstrations, which are stunningly interesting. Mm-hmm. But in conversation, there may not have been much improvement. And he thinks he suggests there may be sort of a plateau. And in some cases, a little while ago, well, different things happen. One thing is some people argue there's been a decline in GPT, maybe in part because it's now using as input its own conversations and sort of getting caught in a rabbit hole. There's been cases where it's apparently gone insane for a few days.
That was only last week, right before Gemini got into trouble. It was like speaking Spanglish and stuff. It was going, it went crazy for, I don't know, an hour or two or something. Yeah.
Which is, you know, all fun and games until you have it work as an air traffic controller or something like that.
Or so, put it in charge of the nuclear arsenal.
Yes, exactly. Exactly. So exciting times, Zad.
Yes, definitely. And yeah, I encourage people to watch that Gary Marcus podcast. I mean, they're he's asking for a lot. I mean, if you look at what has happened in the last year, there has been actual progress.
I mean, you and I have talked about this before, and I think Gary would agree. What happened when ChatGPT GPT-4 was released shocked the world. And I think Gary's honest enough to say it shocked him. It certainly shocked him. I would not have believed we'd have systems that you'd carry on reasonable conversations with. Mm-hmm. And sure, hallucinations, and there's a big debate over whether hallucinations are an intrinsic feature of the system or something that people could work out. You get those, you get these occasional unnatural responses, but man, it's so impressive.
Yeah, it is. I mean, you can find places where it's not, and that where there are clearly limits to the sense in which anyone can claim it understands things. And of course, some people say it doesn't understand things at all. And that's a whole, thing Gary and I argued about, but look, it's early days. It's been less than a year since ChatGPT-4 was released, and 5 will be released this year. And if you just stopped progress right now and let these capabilities filter through the business community and the social community, you would see big change for a year or two to come. I mean, yeah. I just would not worry about things moving too slowly. We'll see. So what else?
Biden?
Yeah, Biden. Getting older, apparently. It is sad.
As he would say, God bless. That's good for him to getting older. Better an alternative.
I've been warning about this since before the last election.
Yeah.
So, I mean, and, you know, he got through with it. Well, he's not through it yet. And obviously some people would say he's already to a point where maybe he shouldn't be president. But in any event, people have probably heard everything I have to say about it. What's your take?
Well, the most recent thing, and I got this through Eric Howell, who's a neuroscientist who has a wonderful Substack, which is far more popular than Small Potatoes, and he's a very sharp guy, and he had this critique of a New York Times article that was something titled something. It began with the words, "I am a neuroscientist," and I said, "And I'm going to tell you a bit about aging and everything."
Right.
And a Hole is merciless in his attack on this, and I think justifiably so. So the "I am a neuroscientist" article says, you know, I know the science of aging, and let me tell you something. Not everybody ages the same way, which is true. There may be super agers who don't have cognitive aging at all. And it was so much framed as this desperate attempt to say, no, don't worry, Biden's cognitive capacities aren't going badly. And Hull points out there's no evidence that super agers exist. There are people who perform fairly well at cognitive tasks at 70 or 80, but those are a tiny minority. And those are probably people who were extraordinary at 30 or 40.
Well, plus the examples he cites as these, you know, people who are, as he says, I think the line is at the top of their game are like, you know, even though they're like late 70s or 80s, like Paul McCartney. You tell me, when was the last Paul McCartney song that you liked?
I mean, so he's had Paul McCartney, Harrison Ford, Jane Fonda, and Martin Scorsese. And I could give him Martin Scorsese.
I haven't seen the latest, but he's done some pretty good movies pretty recently. Yeah.
You know, and the thing is, so I think here's the best defense I could give about Biden and Biden's age, which is there are real worries. Sometimes when you get old, you get dementia. Mm-hmm. And that's a serious problem that would render you unfit for any job like president or most jobs. But the typical profile of aging is you just get slower, your abilities diminish, you have word finding problems, da da, and it starts at about 30,
right?
You know, maybe a bit earlier. So, and it just gradually gets worse. And there's no exceptions. It's just like upper body strength, ability to recover from injury, all of that stuff. When you get old, it just gets worse. But the defense is that, you know, Biden isn't an air traffic controller. He does not depend on splits. It's not clear he ever needs to do split-second decisions, like literally split-second decisions.
I just thought of a premise for a Saturday Night Live sketch, but go ahead. Okay, Biden is air traffic controller, but go ahead.
You know, he's not, you know, he's not an MMA fighter. He's not, he's in a job that you could surround yourself with smart advisors. And maybe somebody could argue that there's a plainly diminishing of cognitive capacities. There's also experience. Yeah. Maybe something one could call wisdom. A certain leveling out of emotional extremes. And I think anybody has to admit it'd be better if Biden were 50 or 60. Or even, and Trump fans would have to say the same about Trump. But it's not clear that the cognitive decline is such a deal breaker.
Yeah. I mean, first of all, 60% of my concern and or 70, and the reason I've been sounding the alarm is not so much about his performance as president, although I'm really not optimistic about how that would be working 3 or 4 years from now, but about whether he can win the election, because I don't want Trump to win. And I'd rather have a Democrat who can win. And I have no doubt that on the age front, there's going to seem to be a big contrast, partly because of levels of energy and verbal quickness. I mean, who knows? You know, drugs can do amazing things. And who knows which of these guys is on which drug at any given time? I mean, John Kennedy was on, I think, amphetamines and various other things. By the way, I have a revisionist. I have a revision of my previous view on the JFK assassination. I'm less sure that there was more than one shooter than I was last time. We'll talk about that maybe in the overtime section.
Maybe in overtime.
I have a radical new theory of the JFK assassination. This could be the thing that ensures me enduring fame long after I'm gone.
I have a talking to Alex Jones feeling right now.
No, I'm moving away. I'm moving a little bit away from Alex Jones territory. We'll get into that. But
the JFK painkillers,
amphetamines, drugs, who knows? But my concern is Biden will just lose the election.
There's something, there's two levels of unfairness here. First thing, Trump, whatever his many, many, many manifest flaws, conveys a degree of high energy because he is extraordinarily energetic person. He seems to be, you know, literally tireless. He sleeps a few hours each night. That's full of energy, and his style of bombast and bullshit is such that it's sort of immune from cognitive decline. You know, he got Nikki Haley and Nancy.
He wasn't finishing his sentences in the first place.
That's right.
Nobody expects that.
It was gibberish to start with.
Right.
You know, he gets Nikki Haley and Nancy Pelosi confused for an extended period of time. Then there's another thing, he says, I did it on purpose.
Right.
I don't know why the media doesn't get this. The crowd goes wild. You know, so that's one aspect of unfairness. The other aspect is more structural, which is it's truly bizarre that we select presidents to a tremendous extent based on, say, debating skills.
Yeah,
which is a skill set which is as quite distant from the on-the-job demands.
Yeah,
you know, you don't have to be quick-witted and smart and excellent for put down and so on in order to run a country. You could be slow, deliberative, fairly inarticulate. It's separate, but that is how he's going to be judged. For people are saying, I think correctly, he has to put himself out there to reassure people. And people are also saying, again, correctly, that any error he makes, and he's old, he's gonna stumble on words. He's gonna he's gonna have word finding problems. Yeah.
I couldn't find sumo wrestler, 20 minutes ago.
No, you said samurai wrestler.
You want me in the Oval Office?
In the comments, do
you,
somebody,
by the way? No, never mind.
Be interesting.
Yeah.
The blob would never stand for it.
It's safe to say. And I will say, I haven't seen the signs. I mean, Reagan supposedly in the final couple of years was really, really in dementia, and they just didn't show him to the public. I haven't seen that in Biden. On the other hand, I got to say, I find it alarming that they turned down an opportunity to do the Super Bowl interview. Okay. Yeah. That's offered to presidents. I take it it's usually a pretty softball interview. That's weird. That's weird. Because he needs it. It's not like he's ahead in the polls.
If he were ahead in the polls, the ideal strategy would for him to hide so he doesn't make a gaffe and then this goes through. He's not. He has to take the chance. But maybe the worry is that he will come off badly. And so there's a cost-benefit analysis where if he does well, that's great. But if he messes it up, it could be fatal.
Yeah. Yeah.
I don't know.
Oh, well. So should we quickly talk about this self-immolation thing?
Yeah, I'm interested in what you think of that.
Philosophical. So, well, first of all, okay. So first of all, a U.S. airman, a serviceman, walked to the Israeli embassy. And as he was walking, somebody was filming him and he was saying, I'm about to engage in an act of extreme protest or something. He was very calm, didn't seem crazy. And then he fell silent for a while as he finished the walk. And he poured some stuff over himself, lit himself on fire and yelled, free Palestine, free Palestine, as he was burning. And then just starts screaming in pain and then tries to yell free Palestine one more time. And he mentioned on the walk up, he said, it's an act of extreme. I think he used genocide or something. He described what he was going to protest about. By the way, it turns out this is in December at the Israeli embassy or consulate in Atlanta. A woman who still has not been identified immolated herself. In that case, there was a Palestinian flag. This guy was like Caucasian, not of any Arab or Muslim heritage. And in fact, first let me say the question that became interesting to me is, you know, an argument broke out on Twitter. Was he just mentally ill? And of course, the people saying he was just mentally ill tend to be people on one side of this whole issue ideologically. And the people who were saying, no, he's a hero of conscience, of course, were on the other side. And, you know, I kind of thought, well, wait a second, the people who are saying he's mentally ill, were they saying that about the Arab street vendor who triggered the Arab Spring? And, you know, I was thinking, I don't remember this whole argument then. And the reason is, you know, in America, it's like when you hear that somebody's protesting against an Arab dictator, it's not a very large contingent that's like against that. So I didn't hear a lot of accusations of mental illness in that case. And I started thinking about this whole thing, this whole question. And I was wondering whether you, as a noted psychologist, have a take on this question.
I mean, it's a deep question because it gets into the question of what mental illness is, which is a matter of a lot of debate by philosophers and by clinical psychologists. And I guess one way to frame it is that one criteria for mental illness is you're not doing well. You're not doing well in society. Mm-hmm. You can't hold a job. Your relationships fall apart. You're miserable. And somebody who kills themselves for the political cause, at first blush, it's a very maladaptive thing to do. It's a very damaging thing to do. And so you say, well, there has to be something wrong with that person. And then I guess the next question is, well, what if they're doing very well at a moral cause? Somebody who gives their life to save thousands of people. The people have given their lives, saved their friends, saved their family. We don't think of mentally ill. We think, what a wonderful person, what a brave, courageous person. A soldier who jumps on a grenade, we don't think, man, if only he had proper psychiatric, advice.
We give him the Medal of Honor.
We give him the Medal of Honor. So the question is, does this fall into this category? And I'm tempted to think no. Putting aside whatever the value of the cause, no, because I don't think this is going to in any way speed up the idea of a ceasefire. It's not going to persuade. It's not going to change Israeli policy. It's not going to change U.S. policy. I think it's considered as bizarre curiosity. So if you judge it by its sort of anticipated results, this wasn't a smart move. And so you have to wonder.
But isn't the question whether he thought I mean, if a soldier jumps on a hand grenade and then for some reason everyone in his platoon dies anyway, still give him the Medal of Honor, right?
So the question is, what did he think? But if he thought, if I do this, this will end the war in Gaza, then the problem then gets pushed back. Why did he have such a foolish view? Because if you asked me ahead of time, said, if somebody sets himself on fire in front of Israeli embassy, is that going to stop the war? Is that going to have a big effect? I say, no, he's going to be considered this crazy act. And so I would then think, I'd then push the pathology into whatever failure of reasoning led to this. So yeah, I do think that there's something psychologically wrong in that. I think that the case, so I'm not saying that all acts of this sort are wrong, but the acts are mentally ill. But the ones that I'm tended to think could come from a healthy mind are one where there's a good moral goal, and there's a reasonable rational assumption that I'm going to take the hit, I'm going to lose my life, but reasonably this is all going to help me sustain the goal. I'm going to save my family. I'm going to save my fellow soldiers. I'm going to end the war, and I don't see that here.
Yeah, I mean, I think, I don't know, there's a long history of this kind of thing. And I think in some cases it is depicted as part of a healthy and ultimately successful protest movement. I mean, the Tunisian fruit vendor does seem to have triggered the Arab Spring. And whether it would have been triggered anyway is another question. I think it also matters, like, well, what was this person like? I mean, there are people who have done things like this who I'm sure were by any definition, obviously mentally ill. You know, that's just everyone would have said, oh yeah, I know him. He was mentally ill. Now, I actually looked into this guy's background and it's kind of interesting. He was raised in this intense religious community in Cape Cod called the Community of Jesus. And it was started in the 60s by these two women who were Episcopalian, actually. They weren't like, you know, Pentecostals or something. So they weren't evangelicals as classically defined. But it became, I guess, a pretty intense thing. They got together with a bunch of women and vowed celibacy. But then families began moving in who had kids. And anyway, just on the home page of this Community of Jesus thing, which still exists, I saw that this is like the third paragraph. So this is pretty prominent. And it says, a central theme began to weave its way through their message, crystallized in the words of Jesus, unless a grain of wheat falls into the earth and dies, it remains alone. But if it dies, it bears much fruit. And then they say, this is no longer in quotes, that was biblical scripture, dying to one's own life, surrendering one's own plans, goals, and selfish desires, they discovered, was the requisite pathway to living for God and others and lay at the heart of what it meant to be a disciple of Jesus Christ. But paradoxically, this was also the way to joy, peace, and love. Now, they didn't mean suicide, but it sounds like maybe. And I should also say that this guy left the community and I think was no longer happy with it, but I don't know whether he disavowed his religious commitment or what, but this kind of message, you know, if it's drummed into you as a kid that this isn't about you, you know, you have to be willing to sacrifice everything for what you believe, that could encourage a person to do something like this. Now, again, I assume in some sense or another, his life was not going swimmingly by standard metrics. Like, was he in a stable romantic relationship? Yeah. He doesn't seem to have been married and so on. But still, I think this is all, looking into this kind of thing should be part of the assessment process. If you're, you know.
No, you're right. I mean, I was all sort of pre-register prediction that if you look, when they look into this guy's life, he will have a history of psychological problems. He will not sort of show what we would view as a healthy, productive life. Mm-hmm. I'm not saying it's impossible for somebody who has stable, loving relationships and rewarding work to do this sort of thing, but I think it's very unlikely. But I also agree. So one out you could always have for saying, look, it's not mental illness, is if this is what the community does, you think about all the things people do in the service of religious belief, you know, ritual scarification, fasting, and so on. And if people did this and there's no religious tradition behind it, you say, that's nuts. You know, it's just bizarre. Right. But if there's a culture behind it that encourages that, then a perfectly healthy mind will adopt those things. So to oversimplify what you're saying, if he's raised with this ethos that this is the best thing you can do, then he could have a healthy psychological processes and then just think this is what you should do.
Yeah. The and another question, does it matter if you believe in an afterlife? Does that mean, well, it's not really irrational? I don't know if he did. I assume the Tunisian fruit vendor did. And then there's the famous Buddhist monk who immolated himself in Vietnam. There were probably more than one, but the famous one that was reported on,
by the way, did not flinch.
If you want to hear about the power of meditation, did not flinch through the whole thing.
It's making me want to go on a silent retreat because, you know, I flinch at the dentist's office.
Well, you know, it's funny you should mention that. I am not comparing myself to anyone of any actual significance, but just as an experiment at a retreat, I as it happened, I developed an abscessed tooth, and so liquid caused me great pain. And you can, in a retreat, you can get to a point where, you know, I meditated for half an hour and then just bathed the tooth in this liquid. And it was an interesting thing. I wouldn't say it was kind of vacillating between like observing the pain and almost seeing it as beautiful. It had this kind of grandeur about it. And then that hurts. But it definitely completely changed my perspective on it.
I read you, I think you wrote the story in your Why Buddhism is True
book. I did.
And I am such in a different space that I found it actively unpleasant to read the story.
Well, I know a guy who, and this maybe inspired the experiment, who went to the dentist and was getting, and just decided, I mean, he's a very serious meditator and has done research in this. He just decided to forego the Novocaine, just drill away and I'll just watch the pain. Like that I don't do.
Yeah.
Yeah,
I would just say that whatever we answer with regard to this guy, it's going to be the same answer with suicide bombers. Because the structure of the question doesn't change.
This guy didn't kill anyone else.
But the question stays the same, which is somebody who kills themselves and kills innocent people. Is that necessarily an act of mental illness? Or could it be, you say, well, innocent people die, but innocent people do die in war. And if it serves this greater good, I think exactly the same questions arise.
Well, then does it arise? Two other cases come to mind. The Hamas attack on Israel, where they chose to kill civilians, and what Israel's doing now, where they know damn well a certain number of civilians are going to die. They deny targeting them. But even if they don't, any kind of case where you know there will be a certain amount of collateral damage and civilians will die, but you're saying it's justified. Is that comparable to suicide bombing? I don't think it's so obvious that it's not, personally. The Hamas thing is more obviously comparable. Yeah. The Hamas attack, maybe. I'm not sure that upon... Anyway, go ahead.
I see what you're saying. But at a sort of higher level, what's the difference between a suicide bomber versus a politician who orders a certain attack to happen? And morally, there's the same cost-benefit questions. I just think psychologically, and I'm not making a moral judgment, but when you do things sort of, you're sitting in a committee in a conference room and making a decision, you can do dumb and cruel decisions. But because the stakes to yourself are not so enormously high, a self-destructive decision doesn't necessarily manifest as, doesn't give rise to thoughts, oh, wow, you're crazy. Like, so you may not like...
Well, sure, I'm distinguishing between self-destructive and killing others.
Yeah.
And I'm saying that this guy didn't kill anyone. I don't mean that means he wasn't mentally ill, but I think he's on a higher moral plane than a whole lot of people because he didn't hurt anybody else.
So what do you think? about him?
Well, I think, you know, mental illness, it's almost a question of definition. And, you know, you can say, well, was he classically mentally ill? We kind of agree on that, what that means. And we don't yet know enough about him to say that. Had he been in and out of treatment? And then, you know, I think there's a version of this kind of self-sacrifice that I would definitely say is not mentally ill, and you could argue reflects a certain kind of heroic self-sacrifice and enlightenment. I don't know what category I'd put this in. I don't know enough about him. But I admire people who sacrifice for a good cause. You know, short of self-immolation. And I guess in a certain sense, it's not obvious to me if they believe, and even if you want to do the full-on thought experiment, let's suppose it's true. He could really make an impact by doing this and ultimately save 5,000 lives in Gaza. Let's just do that thought experiment. Then is he crazy or is he, if he even believes that, I'm not sure I'd say he's crazy.
I guess I'd wonder whether the answer could be both. So it could be something is a transcendently great thing to do. It's just a wonderful thing to do. And you could think of other examples. You could think of people who give away all their money, you know, mm-hmm. give away all their money and live in total poverty and help others that way. You could say this is a wonderful thing to do. It does suggest that the psychological functioning isn't normal.
It's not normal. It's not normal.
Yeah, but you wouldn't say it's just abnormal. Yeah, wonderful. Yeah, is by definition abnormal.
Yeah,
but maybe not illness. Yeah, I don't know. I'd have to know more about this case. I guess I'm just swayed by the fact that I don't think it's going to make a huge difference. And if he thought otherwise, then there in itself is a problem of reasoning.
Yeah, I don't think it's going to make a huge difference. It's funny. I was thinking it might make more of a difference if he had done it in front of the White House, because Biden is actually feeling political pressure on this. And I think that's pushing him to push for ceasefire. And I personally think it would have been more politically powerful if he'd done it right in front of the White House.
That may be.
It hasn't gotten as much coverage as I think it would have.
Yeah, that might be.
But so this is actually kind of related to the movie Harvey, which we're not going to discuss now, but I'm encouraging you to watch the Jimmy Stewart.
All I know is Jimmy
movie.
Stewart and the Rabbit. But I've never seen it, and I'm looking forward to seeing it.
Among the many issues raised are what is mental illness? It's not the central issue by any means, but you've said at some point you'll watch that, and at some point we may discuss it.
I'm very interested in the question. I mean, this comes up a bit where people who are very enthusiastically diagnosing Trump as having some sort of mental illness,
mm-hmm.
maybe narcissism or narcissistic personality disorder or something like that. And in fact, every president sooner or later gets diagnosed by somebody as having psychopathy. Certainly Clinton did, and you know, so on. In some ways, it's just a political tool to smear your enemies. But suppose it's true that from meet some characteristics of mental illness. Still, he is, by many measures, an immensely successful person.
Mm-hmm.
He got the job that is probably one of the most prestigious jobs in the world. Say, you can't say that for most of the shrinks who are calling him names. So does that mean you could do well in life but have a mental illness? And if so, what makes an illness?
Yeah.
Those are once I see Harvey, I'd be better positioned to answer those questions.
Yeah, I guess the pragmatic version of the question is what we're calling his mental illness, like say the narcissism, something that would lead him to, as president, do a very bad job of serving America's and the world's interests. That's what I mainly care about. I mean, you know, narcissism, like many of these things, and this is kind of an EvSite perspective, lots of mental illnesses are basically normal human tendencies with the knob, you know, turned up to 11.
Yeah.
You know, depression, you know, sadness is normal and functional. Unipolar depression is not.
Yeah.
And so on.
There's a big debate in psychology, a very interesting debate, which is, are these disorders like major depression, OCD, schizophrenia, are they separate things, like getting COVID, like getting cancer? or are they just, these things lie in a continuum? And at a certain point, we say too much. So it's like saying you have high blood pressure, or somebody's eyes are obese or whatever. It's just at a certain point, you just say, here's the cutoff. We say that that's troublesome.
Right.
And but the proper psychological theory says it's a continuum, not a separate thing. And I think it's interesting. I think some things are like that and some things aren't. I think depression is like that. I think unipolar depression is like that, which is some sadness is good. Too much sadness, we call it an illness. And it's a social question where you draw the cut. And there's nothing wrong with that. Other things like bipolar depression probably are just their own separate disease. They're not an extension of normal functioning. Pedophilic desires are not, you know, it's not like everybody is attracted to eight-year-olds to some extent. And if you're too attracted, we say you have a problem. No, it's its own separate thing.
Right.
I used to think schizophrenia was an example of something which is its own separate thing, like cancer.
Mm.
A friend of mine who's a shrink was telling me there's a lot of data suggesting that schizophrenia itself lies in a continuum, which is just sort of schizotypical individuals who are sort of florid and kind of a little bit unmoored from reality. And then you just get too much, it falls into schizophrenia.
Mm. Yeah, well, there's also the fact that you can induce some symptoms, you know, that are somewhat reminiscent of that through drugs, including recreational drugs.
Amphetamine psychosis is like schizophrenia.
You know, even some psychedelics, I think, give you some features of it. But so, Paul, we've reached the part of the conversation where there was a controversy recently raised by a commenter. Should I describe the paywall as going up or coming down? If it's a wall, I guess it goes up, right? If it was a curtain, it would come down.
That's right. We could discuss that.
We'll discuss that behind the paywall.
Yeah, behind the paywall.
Behind the paywall. We'll discuss that. Also, I've been advised not to be that crass about it and call it a paywall and say that it's available to paid subscribers of the Non-Zero newsletter. I should say it's available to, like, what is it? Like, I don't know, members or premium subscribers or something? What do you think?
Yeah, I wouldn't call it a paywall at all. It's just a different space we're moving to.
It's a liminal. We're going to pass through a liminal space.
Yeah, and some people can, if they choose to, come with us, and others will stay behind. And that's totally up to them.
Yeah, because why should a person want deep philosophical insight and spiritual fulfillment, which is what awaits them behind the paywall?
And excellent gossip.
And trash talk about Gary Marcus.
No, you wish.
Well, look, it's within my power to provide some. I will listen.
Being
Paul Bloom will go, listen, he, like the rest of humankind, is among my friends, and I have nothing bad to say.
We're all God's children.
I'm for the trash talk.
Okay.
Exactly. So anyway, we are not yet to the point where Small Potatoes has paid subscribers. Is that right? Because you're too busy with your jihad on the smaller Small Potatoes.
What a wonderful term to describe my response to a rabbi, right, who grows potatoes.
Right.
That's what I need.
But that's what you're doing.
I haven't done the. Here's why I got to say I'm thinking of having a paid tier because I'd like the money. I mean, there's no other reason to want to pay.
We're not supposed to be that crass.
Yeah, but I'm happy to do all sorts of things. Advise me here.
Mm-hmm.
Writing is for me enjoyable but hard, and if I have a paid level, there's going to be much fewer people there. Why I would frustrate me to write something that I can't distribute to anybody I want. It's not like that these are gems, but I want people to read my stuff. So how do I deal with that,
folks? The answer to Paul's question lies behind the paywall. We thank everyone who's this is what the pros do. They fade out the audio right when, and so did you kill her? And then the audio fades out. And so we will find out the answer to that question and many other things in overtime. But thanks to everyone who has stayed with us this far, whether or not you're staying with us the rest of the way. Also rate and review, smash the like button and so on. And
like us on Apple Podcasts.
And that too. And now we head into overtime.